You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 47 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and get help on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, so things like moves and combinations and choreographies, it's really easy to find resources. But if you want to dig deeper into the why and the how, so things like culture, musicality, stage presence, composition, culture, all of that stuff is a whole lot harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Alia Thabit, who is joining us for the third time. Alia is an Arab American and a Vermont juried artist and specializes in performance, composition, and live music improvisation. As an instructor, she emphasizes creativity and self-expression grounded in traditional Oriental dance values. Alia trained in New York City with Ibrahim Farah, Dunya McPherson, and Alina Lentini. She continues her study with international artists and dance adventures in Lebanon, Palestine, Brazil, and Egypt. Alia has received grants in Vermont and New Hampshire, appeared off-Broadway on radio and on television. She's danced on three continents in six countries and 15 states, produced myriad shows, directed a dance company, presented seminars, and performed internationally with world-class musicians. Now, she didn't mention this, but I want to promote this a little bit. She's also the author of the book Midnight at the Crossroads: Has Belly Dance Lost Its Soul, which is available for pre-order now. So you can check out her and her book at aliathabit.com. That's aliathabit.com. So welcome, Alia.
Hi. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. I'm really glad to have you back. So tonight, Alia is going to talk about how the gift of authentically sharing your feelings with the audience can enrich not just your performance, but also both of your experiences. So before we jump too deeply into the topic, can you tell us about how you got started in belly dance?
Well, there was a lady down the block giving lessons, and I was 16, and I thought it would be cultural and sexy, because I'm Arabic on my father's side, so the whole cultural thing was very appealing to me, and so was the sexy part, because I was 16.
And you said that you did go on to study in New York. Is that where you were then?
Yeah, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and when the gal down the street got tired of giving lessons, she said, well, you know, if you guys want to keep going, you can go to the class that I go to. And she went to Bobby Farah's professional class. So I was like, oh, this is different.
Sorry, go ahead.
That worked. I stayed with Bobby for several years until I finally moved out of New York City.
And can you tell us how you got interested in this topic?
Well, I've been writing this book, and that made me delve more deeply into it. But because the dance was always a cultural activity for me, I was very interested in the cultural underpinnings of the dance. And also, when I started dancing, it was back in the 70s, so it was very much a dance of expression. It was an improvised dance of expression. And the general idea was the dancer shows the audience what she feels from the music. And, you know, and even Bobby would say, you know, dancers don't really have anything to say until they're in their 30s and 40s. And that was an interesting concept, because I always felt like I had something to say, so I didn't necessarily agree with him. But it was the idea that, you know, you had to have some life before you had something to express. So this whole idea that the dance was an expressive act was sort of there from the beginning. And I kept hearing from dancers of the culture, the most important thing is the feeling, the most important thing is the feeling, like everyone. And so I just kept going further and further down that rabbit hole, sort of.
And can you tell us about some of the different stages that you went through as you were figuring out what the feeling means to you?
Well, originally, my understanding of the feeling was the emotional timbres that exist already in the music. That as the music has these emotional timbres in them, we pick them up. We like the whole thing about feel the music. Feel the music meant, feel and appreciate those emotional timbres. So I thought it was like the emotional feeling from the music. And then relatively recently, I was in Vancouver. Sorry. It's like, where the hell was I?
So Alia just flew halfway around the world this month, and I think last week, right? So.
Oh, yeah, but this was like a year, 2 years ago, maybe. Anyways, I was in a workshop with David of Scandinavia, and he pointed out He pointed out that the word in Arabic for feeling, ahsas, means not just emotional feeling, but also physical feeling, just like the English word, you know, but somehow that never really crossed my mind. So that the feeling also had to do with physical feeling. So that I really started to think about that. Because when you let yourself go inside and feel how it feels to do the movements of the dance, they're incredibly delicious. Like it feels really good. You can feel your muscles sliding over each other, and you can, you know, feel all this stuff happening in your body as the muscles contract and expand. And it's remarkably nice. So I really started thinking about that too. And all of these things started to come together with all the other things that I was investigating. And I realized, like, we have this whole huge part of the dance we sort of haven't had much opportunity to explore.
And why do you think it is so hard for us to explore that and really open up authentically as opposed to putting on a pretty facade?
There's a lot of reasons, I think. First of all, we're only really, most of the time, most of the classes that I've been to, and I've been to quite a lot of classes, you know, I just kind of randomly drop into classes because I go visit dancers a lot. And I drop into classes, and most people don't really focus on anything that has to do with that at all. They focus on technique. We all focus on technique, and we're all supposed to like look in the mirror and look at how we look. We're supposed to only focus on how we look and work on perfection of form and stylization and things like that. Have you noticed that? Because that's what I see a lot. Mm-hmm. However, that's a very Western point of view. And the Eastern point of view is a lot looser and more interpretive. So first of all, there's that most people are just taught to focus on technique, and they're taught to do choreography, and they're taught that it's supposed to be the same every time. And the feeling, quote unquote, is something that you choreograph in with these little stylized expressions, you know, and you put your little finger to your cheek, you know, and you make a little cute face or a sad face or whatever kind of little face that you make. So I think a lot of it is just that we don't get that kind of education, if that makes sense. And then the other part is that it's scary. It's very scary to do that stuff. And I think that people don't do it because it's scary. So part of it is just not learning how to do it. And then the other part is even when people tell you, because people are like, oh, feel the music. People are always telling you to feel the music. They don't teach you how to do that. And it's, but connecting to a group of people like that is a pretty scary thing. When I was early in my performing career, I was better with a group of strangers than with people that I knew. It was far more threatening to dance in front of people that I knew. And even when I danced in front of strangers, I don't think I was really connecting to them. I was having a fairly authentic experience myself, but my level of stagecraft just wasn't good enough to really be present with all those people. And I was still often like stuck in my head and thinking and stuff like that. So it took a long time to get past that. Does that make sense?
It does.
So I can't speak for everyone, but that's certainly my experience.
Yeah. And, you know, are there certain forces or trends in the dance world or in society at large that really push us to be in that stuck in the head space rather than opening up?
Well, where everything is pushed towards choreography from what I see. There's a lot of push towards choreography. There's a lot of push towards stylization and doing things the same way every time, as I was mentioning before. I see a lot of this Western mindset that is about precision and athleticism and stylization and ever more fancy technique and being impressive, you know, like technically impressive, as opposed to more of an Eastern mindset that's about enjoying your time with the people and bringing everybody into this beautiful space. The Eastern mindset is more like, here we are all together. Isn't it lovely? I love you so much. I'm so happy that you're here. It's very giving, like a giving of love to the guests, as opposed to, look at me, I'm really great, or I'm really, you know, I don't know why I'm here. I'm really not good enough to be here, but I'm going to stomp my way through this anyway. Or any of the other many sorts of mindsets that we take with us onto the stage.
And why do you think choreography has become so dominant in the dance world, given that it wasn't even possible decades ago?
I think it's because of recorded music. Because if you have recorded music, why should you not record your dance? The music's not going to change no matter how many times you play it, where live music from the culture will change every single time they play it. So I think recorded music, just that, and pretty much all we have, most people have, is available to them is recorded music. And it's great that we have recorded music. You know, it's like, wow. We couldn't have any of the stuff that we have not so long ago. We'd had hardly any recorded music, and you know, you had to have a record player. And now you can have like a little gizmo the size of a matchbook and have 10,000 songs in there. That's pretty amazing. You can get great music, and you can listen to old music by like master artists, and it's fantastic. But I also think at the same time that recorded quality made it easier to make those stylized pre-recorded dances. So instead of having a genuine experience to the music and sharing that with your guests, you're sort of reading off the dance teleprompter in your head, you know, what are you going to do next? Always knowing exactly what you're going to do next is about control. Improvising and being in the moment is about a sort of mindful flow that is open to infinite possibility at every moment.
So, you know, why is this a problem? What do we lose by trying to control every aspect of our performance?
Well, it's not so much fun. And I say that, and the people who were raised on choreography find improvisation very scary because it's a completely different skill set. And people who are raised on improvisation often find choreography to be just horrific. Again, it's a completely different skill set. And it takes time to learn to do either of those things. The problematic, so each of those are very valid and valuable relationships and engagements with dance and music. So I'm not like anti-choreography. I like making dances. I like, performing a well-made dance. That's really not my issue. My issue is, first of all, the cultural underpinning of the dance, which is about improvisation. So that's one first part of the problem, is that it's Western values that are overlying Eastern values, where the Eastern values of the dance are being superseded by Western values. So that's kind of an issue for me right there. That's a problem. However, one of the things that was important to me while I was writing the book is, well, why is this important?
I think we lost Ali. I'm going to unmute you.
Sorry,
All
I
right.
don't
I
know how
think the
that
last thing we
happened.
heard was you were asking yourself for the book, why is this important?
Yeah, okay. Boy, that was odd. Because we can't just say, oh, we did it like this in the past, so now we should always do it that way, because things evolve. So there has to be there has to be something more than, well, this is how we did it before. Why do we do it like that? And what are the benefits of doing it like that? And that was really a big journey because the whole third part of the book is in, well, it's in four parts. The first part is examination of the Eastern mindset and Eastern music, Eastern dance, and the values and principles that guide, not guide isn't the right word, but underpin, I guess is a good word, underpin the music and the dance. The second part of the book looks at the of this, and there's some history in there too, a little bit of history. The second part of the book looks at the differences between Eastern and Western mindsets and where there are conflicts and how we might bypass some of those conflicts. And then the third part of the book is about the benefits of improvisation. And so I divided that into three parts: the mind, the body, and the soul.
Can you tell us more about each of those?
Yes, I will. Improvisation really has a lot going for it that I hadn't really thought about before. I knew that I liked it and I knew that it felt good for me and all that kind of stuff. But the material that came up was really quite interesting. So for the first part, for like the mind and brain health, Stanford University did a 20-year study on how various activities impacted the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. My mother has dementia, and the neurologist told me that a third of us will have dementia. A third. Like, this is a huge amount of people. I don't see how a third, it used to be a third, but it's like, oh, we're living longer. Whatever. I'm not keen on having dementia. It is not a pretty picture. So, anyways, they did this 20-year study, and what they found was that dancing was the most protective out of all of the activities and the only physical activity that was protective, frequent dancing. They didn't study different kinds of dance, they just said frequent dancing. So, this guy whose name is escaping me at the moment, it's in the book, but I can't remember him right now. He's a ballroom dance professor, a ballroom dance teacher at Stanford. And he looked at that study, and then he looked at a bunch of other studies that also were looking at brain health and What kind of activities are protective of cognition and so forth. And what he found was that, or what he theorized, was that in ballroom dance, for example, it's the follower who gets the most benefit, because the follower has to always be open to interpret the invitation of the leader. And in tango, you have leaders and followers too. The leader invites, but the follower goes ahead and does what they're going to do. So the leader could follow their own patterns. They could do things that they routinely do, but the follower is always having to be open and listening for what way they're going to go. What he found was that it is being open to a lot of possibilities in the moment, and constantly being open to that was what was the protective part. And that's really what improvisation is. You're always like floating or diving, but you're always open. You're always like kind of looking and seeing and having a bit of a big picture so that you can go in whatever direction seems to be the way to go. Once you go, you really have to go with your whole heart. Like, you can't screw around. You have to really dive. And in some ways, it's like playing sports, you know, like you kind of always having to be like recalculating and running here and going there and doing that.
Can I jump in for a second? Because I have a story that so ties into that.
Oh, please tell.
You know, in, what was it, 2003, I was in Poland. I was at a university language program for the summer, part of the summer. And one of my friends in this program, who was the only person who wasn't like 19, I was in grad school, he had been a professional soccer player, and he was a goalie. And you know, the story that he told us was that someone is kicking the ball towards the goal. Your brain doesn't register what you've seen for the kick until after the ball has already passed you. So if you wait to be absolutely sure where they're pointing the ball, you're going to miss it. So you have to guess where they're going based on everything that you observe unconsciously about the kick, and then jump as hard as you can for wherever you think that place is going to be. And you just have to trust that instinct and completely commit to that decision, because if you hold back, you're going to miss it. If you wait to know for sure what it's going to be, you're going to miss it. So your only chance of success is to fully commit and hope for the best.
Yes. And you can't mess around thinking, because you just have to react and you have to trust your body to do that for you. You train so that you can trust your body to react for you. Your hearing is one of your fastest senses. And the music is coming in your ears, and you're just letting your body respond to it when you improvise.
Awesome. So we've been talking about the body.
Go ahead.
I think you said you had three areas that you wanted to talk about. Did I cut you off?
Yeah. No, body, mind, and soul. No, mind, body, and soul. We were talking about the mind, actually.
Gotcha. All right.
So that whole, all that improvisation stuff is good for your brain. And a following, by the way, is good for your brain too. Like, I always hear people kind of complaining about that Egyptian follow the bouncing butt style of teaching. But allowing yourself to follow is very good for your brain. It kind of relaxes you out of control mode and teaches you how to get out of your own way. Okay, so brain, body, obviously exercise is good for you, but one of the things that I think, this is going to sound like it's a mind thing, but it's actually a body thing. A lot of people have a lot of like emotional and anxiety issues with their dance. They're very self-critical. they have all those bad little voices in their heads that are telling them, oh, you can't, and this is stupid, and, you know, why do you even try, and, you know, why don't you just kill yourself? Hopefully it's not that bad, but basically we have a lot of voices in our head, these voices of resistance that are telling us to pack it in and, you know, those voices are like chemical wisps. I'm losing myself for a second here, but I'll come back to it. I've done a lot of things for my own well-being. And I've tried a lot of things, and some of them have worked, and some of them have worked pretty good, but none of them really managed those voices. And the voices were very powerful. So it wasn't until I started looking into trauma resolution and working with that stuff that that situation really changed. Now, we think about things like that as being mental things, but they're actually physical things, because the current research seems to be pretty clear that trauma is not event-based, it's body-based. It's like things happen, and even being like yelled at is a thing that can be traumatic, because trauma just means that you are in this place where you feel helpless. So, you know, some big person is yelling at you and you're just a little person, you can't go anywhere or do anything. Even something that seems relatively minor like that can have a lasting effect. I think that the reason a lot of us aren't able to or don't connect and whatnot on stage is because we have too many negative thoughts in our heads all the time. You know, all those, like, we're thinking and, oh my God, is this okay? Do they like me? All that kind of stuff. That's actually physical. When people are put in unmanageable situations, whatever kind of unmanageable situation, there are physical reactions to that. The nervous system, like all of the nervous system is pouring all those flight and fight or flight chemicals into the body, you know, adrenaline and all of those things. But if you can't fight or fly, they just keep adding up. And then the body throws like a blanket on top of it. It's like having the engine of a car revving at the same time as you have your foot on the brake. So everything is screaming, but the car isn't going anywhere. And you feel very like kind of numbed out. And there's reasons for this. It's to protect you from getting crunched by predators, basically. So you're going to get eaten. The body is going to like turn off a lot of stuff so that that's not as terrible as it might be. So we haven't really come very far from those wild roots where we were running from predators and all of these protective devices were very strong. In my experience, those bad voices were related to these things. And I can't, like, I'm sure I can't even remember 3/4 of the times in which I felt helpless. You know, some parent was yelling at me or walking down a dark street or all kinds of different things that have happened. It's not necessary, actually, to remember them, but it is necessary to release them, because when you aren't able to fight or fly, there's like a short circuit in the body, and the protective energy of the adrenaline and everything isn't able to complete its mission. So it literally gets like stuck. And so there are little places where there are like little bits of stuck energy. and they just stay there. Like, if have you ever had a muscle spasm?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a muscle just kinks up like that. Those don't go away by themselves, just as an example. I've asked a lot of body workers because I couldn't believe this. I'm like, well, doesn't it like just unwind after a while? And they're like, oh, no, nah. You have to actually manually undo those things. They don't necessarily go away. Really? Well, these little stuck bits of energy are kind of like that. They don't necessarily go away by themselves. When we improvise and we let the body move as it wishes, there is an opportunity to release these little short circuits, particularly when you move in very slow motion. And that is a strategy for learning improvisation. And it's also a strategy for releasing this stuff. Because when you're moving in slow motion, you can feel when you've come to a little stuck place, and you can like ooze through that in a way that releases that and lets it drain out of the body. Am I making sense so far?
Yes. And you know, didn't you mention somewhere in your writing that you know, this is actually in clinical use? In therapy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the model that I'm studying, the model that resonated most for me, and that I'm actually, I just entered a 3-year training program for this model, is called somatic experiencing. And the way that they work is by what they call titration and pendulation. So titration means like a little tiny drop of something that's kind of volatile, just a little tiny drop. So you don't you go to talk therapy and they want you to talk about this stuff, these bad things that happen to you, and it just makes you feel them all over again. They don't do that. They're not into that. They're into like, oh, we're just going to get to where we feel a little bit, like a little bit of an edge, and then we go away from that edge. Because what happens is that there's like this stuckness. And the body normally goes back and forth between activation and deactivation all the time. Animals go back and forth between activation and deactivation and even freeze and normalness, some of them many times a day, and it doesn't do them any harm. As long as the freeze is dissipated, then everything is great. And it's only when it isn't dissipated that it causes a problem. So all of these things from trauma resolution, we're like, well, we do that in belly dance. One of the very famous models is EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And in that one, you kind of like bring the trauma up a little bit into your rational mind, and then you move the eyes back and forth and up and down, and that helps to dissipate it. Because all this trauma stuff is preverbal parts of the brain. It's not about reason. There's nothing reasonable about it. It's entirely and completely physical, and it's kind of on autopilot. We don't have a lot of control over it. So in belly dance, we do all those cute little sidelong glances and drop our eyes and look up, and there's all this midline crossing. Everything in belly dance crosses the midline. I mean, every move in belly dance crosses the midline. Our arms are constantly going back and forth. We're constantly like looking in opposition to the body. There's all this stuff. And then once I was getting into the more somatic methods, then there was the slow movement and a lot of breath practices, and all of these things are part and parcel of this trauma resolution and stress resolution. And you know how you go to a class and you're in a crappy mood and you kind of stomp in there like, and then you come out and you're like, I'm happy now.
Yep.
It's not just the exercise. It's really the dance. It has these magical qualities. So I thought of this, and so I got in touch with this gal, Cynthia Merchant, who is a somatic psychotherapist who's worked with Peter Levine for quite a long time. She'd also worked with, I do a lot of work with Dunya McPherson in Sufi Dance, and that's the next part of it. So Cynthia had also worked with her and also done a lot of Sufi dance, not whirling. I'll get to that in a minute, but dance. And so she was like my mentor through this. She helped me figure out, you know, what to write about this and how it works. I'm not just like coming at this off the top of my head. I've actually like read a bunch and had several conversations with her, and she vetted this chapter. So this is like actually a real thing. And it's very exciting to me that you can just dance for a little while and let go of a lot of stuff. And when this, in this model, when these things go, they're gone. It's not symptomatic relief. Like, it's really gone. It's finished. You finish the cycle and then it's done, which is pretty miraculous, honestly. There's of course more and like deeper ways that you can go with it, but for a book that is going to go out to people, I kept it on the manageable side. And there's also a lot of information in there, like if you do start to feel triggered, what you can do, you know, open your eyes, ground yourself in the present moment. There's breath practices and things like that. People who have a lot of trauma would probably do best to work with a trauma therapist. That's my personal opinion. I found it really helpful for me. And I advise anyone who like has a lot of like really a lot of anxiety or, you know, stuff that they know is an issue for them to explore that, because you can go a lot faster with a professional person who really knows what they're doing. And the somatic experiencing people have a very good practitioner directory. But you can do a surprising amount all by yourself just by closing your eyes and, you know, letting your body move and, you know, going in slow motion and kind of feeling where you feel little locked up spots and exhaling them and, you know, letting them drain. How do they want to leave your body? Trauma always wants to leave the body. The body is always seeking regulation. It wants to be regulated and whole. So it's always going to do that. And one of the big principles is to opt for the most pleasurable movement. And all of a sudden, that's connecting with this thing about, you know, the feeling and the physical feeling and how good these movements feel when you do them. So opting, because we're always like, harder is better. Mastery, you know, difficulty equals mastery. The harder, more difficult things you can do, the better the dancer you are. Maybe we're looking in the wrong direction. Maybe mastery is more about enjoying what you're doing and sharing that joy with your guests so that everybody is lifted up into this place of joy. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's body, and body leads very naturally to soul. The three books, the first one is called The Feeling in the Moment. The second, the three like little books within the book. The Feeling in the Moment. The second one is Different Every Time. And the third one, which is the Mind, Body, and Soul, is Bring the Joy. And to me, that's the trifecta of like oriental dance, the feeling in the moment, different every time, and bring the joy. So when you have all of this like richness going on in the body, that next step is looking at the benefits of improvisation for the soul. And you know what? It's not far-fetched of me to say this about belly dance and trauma resolution. It's not far-fetched at all, because people are studying yoga for its effect in trauma resolution, and people are studying Tai Chi, and people are studying other things. And it seems to be clear that a lot of these ancient mind-body systems have they have modulation, where you're not like in the gym, like blowing yourself out for an hour, just like going flat out as hard as you can. But, you know, they're like fast and slow and cool down. And, you know, in a yoga class, you always have Shavasana at the end, where you just lie on the floor for a while. And it's like, why can't the whole class be like this? So belly dance has, again, it organically has a lot of modulation in it. Especially if you look at the five-part routine, it's fast and then it slows down and then it gets more upbeat and then it gets really slow and really fast. And, you know, and then at the end, it's like, now we're going to lie around and have a drink. So there's a lot of evidence for this as a real thing. And I've pulled a lot of things together. Okay, and moving on now to the soul. Sufi dance, not whirling. You know, you've seen whirling dervishes, I'm sure, at least pictures of them, or you've seen them in real life, or you've done some whirling in a class. Whirling is great, and it's a thing, but it's not what we're talking about when I say Sufi dance. And when I say Eastern mindset, I really mean the lands of this dance. And I like the term Oriental dance because it really refers to that part of the East, even though everybody now thinks that means Asian. And I know that Oriental dance is a hot button for some people, because you wouldn't call people Oriental, because, you know, that would be insulting. You refer to people as Asian, if they are Asian. But you can still refer to things as Oriental, for example, Oriental carpets, Orientalism, and Oriental dance. So when I say Eastern, I'm talking about the lands of the dance, the homelands of our dance.
So Sufism also comes from the homelands of our dance. It predates Islam. It was certainly around at the birth of Islam, just like our dance, as far as we know, predates Islam. And being as our dance is the home style dance of the peoples, many of the peoples of that region, it is really not that surprising that the Sufi dance would have the same movement vocabulary and the same music, because they're peoples of that region. However, Sufi dance has a different intention. What we're talking about here, there's a lot of different sects of Sufis, and some of them are very devout, and, you know, some of them aren't so devout. And what we're really interested in here is Sufi mysticism, because mysticism is not religious. It's not religion. You can be of any religion you want and, you know, be involved in mysticism. Mysticism is a personal relationship to the divine. That's it. Doesn't have anything to do with what religion you are. So it's a personal relationship with the divine, however you choose to conceptualize that. If you believe in God, then the mystic side of that is your personal relationship with God. If you believe in the universe, if you believe in whatever. So the Sufis characterized God, Allah, as the beloved. And there's like reams and reams of Sufi poetry that's all dedicated to the beloved and to, you know, wine and song and sort of being in love. And all of that was, for them, was referencing Allah, because God is the beloved. And we're not really gonna get into that. Just our focus is on this whole mystic piece, because the way that is the intention of Sufi dance is that connection to the divine. So Sufi dance is directed inward
where all of us have been encouraged to direct our dance outward. We're all trying to direct our dance outward and look as perfect as we can with our perfect technique and our perfect costume and our perfect hair and all that stuff. And sure, you need to look good if you're going to be a performer and you're going to be on stage. And sure, you have to have good technique. And that's another issue, is how much our dance is pushed towards performance. Because in the East, it's not about performance. It's the home style dance of all these people, and the vast majority of them do not perform, do not want to perform, and never will perform, and, you know, don't really feel too bad about it, because that's not the way things go for them. You can argue that it's because performance is definitely seen as a, you know, a sort of a negative activity. But if you think about this, like, how many people expect an audience for their yoga practice? You know, they just go to yoga class, and maybe they go to a retreat, and it's great. And most of them don't even want to be yoga teachers, you know, just the ones who need to make some money. But most people, it's just something that they do for, you know, nourishment and pleasure. And this dance has a lot of that in it. And we've lost a lot of that with our relentless pushing towards performance. I'm a performer. I don't have a problem with anybody performing, but I do think that this push is part of where we're having some issues. I'm not sure it's the most healthy way that we could do things. So this other model, this interceptive model, is about closing your eyes and letting your body respond to the music. And often in very slow motion. It's very, very slow motion. And this is such a, and using breath, using like a rhythmic breath. People who know me have all heard me talk about rhythmic breath. It's a very, very light, shallow breath. And you breathe with the rhythm and you exhale on the beat. So I'm going to breathe into my microphone for a second, but it's going to be so loud when I do it. And when I actually do it, it's very shallow, and it isn't loud at all. So even you have, say, upbeat music, you're moving in super slow motion and you're breathing in time to the music. So the breath connects you to the music, but the slow motion allows you to float over the music. And all of a sudden, you really don't have anything to worry about anymore. You don't have like, well, what am I going to do next? Because you're moving so slowly that it really doesn't matter what you do next. You're just floating. And you really have an opportunity to let your body respond to the music however it wants, and like find those, any place that's tight, and breathe into it and exhale it and release it. And it's pretty magical. And it's funny because I know we're like, but technique, technique. I tell you, if you do your, even if you just go straight through and do like the belly dance moves that you normally do, as opposed to completely letting yourself float free, when you are moving super slow and you're putting all, it's like Tai Chi belly dance, I guess, you're putting all this energy into creating the most beautiful line and the most beautiful shape, and being really like mindful and just taking great pleasure in the movement. You're using a lot of muscles, and you're using all of these really nice little small muscles, and you're like oiling everything up, and things work very well. Am I making sense so far? It's really not the way we usually get taught to do anything. And it's astoundingly effective. And it is just so soothing and lovely to do. So you're really getting a chance to take pleasure in the movement and take pleasure in the moment and be grounded in the music, but not be driven by it and not have to have any anxiety or anything like that.
over time, you can like, you can speed up and you can slow down. My style has changed now so that my style is this really interesting constant flux between fast and slow, contraction and expansion. And really, to me, this is very much the way the dance is, because each of the moves of the dance has this like contraction and then this expansion. Like they all have this sort of push pull taffy like quality. And when you move really slow, that quality is magnified. And the breath part is really important, because I've never been in a belly dance class. Rania Renee is the only person that I knew for a long time who talked anything about breath, but I was in dance for years before she started doing breath stuff, and there's just not that much. But in every single other mind-body practice, breath is an integral part, and breath that goes with the movement and various breathing strategies, meditation, all of them incorporate breath. So I really feel that this breath piece kind of fell out, because people originally, I'm guessing that people originally would have taken it for granted and nobody really thought about teaching it. But I know that I held my breath all the time. And I think that most of the people that I know have, if not now, had periods in their life when they held their breath a lot when they dance. Like you do something hard and you hold your breath while you do it. That's a real, like, kind of a fear-based thing. So exhaling is what calms the body. Inhaling is like exciting, and exhaling is relaxing. So anytime you are stressed, exhaling is going to relax you. The first breath strategy that I learned from the trauma therapist was to exhale twice as long as my inhale. Man, you take three or four breaths like that, and all of a sudden you're like mellow. And, you know, before that, you were like, oh my God, oh my God. It's very effective. And you can build a lot of breath things into the dance so that when you're moving, your body is causing the breath to move in and out of you just because you like open up your airway and let that happen. Have I gotten really too far afield now?
We have, but I like it.
Okay.
That's usually when we go to good places. So.
Okay.
I also feel like that kind of ties into, you know, kind of the overemphasis on technique, is that so many people drill so hard to make sure that nothing that they do affects their breath. And in a lot of ways, I've had to train myself out of some of those things.
Mm. Yeah, I don't understand a lot of the places that we've gotten to in hindsight. I just kind of don't understand it. I've been to beginner classes that were so incredibly boring because all people did was drill and stylize. Like, when do we get to dance? There's no dancing. It's like bizarre to go to a dance class and there's no dancing. It's bizarre to go to a dance class where all the people are going to do for 2 months is work on the same stinking choreography. It's like, ugh. Because you're not going to learn from endless stylization and drilling. You're not going to learn how to allow your body to create dance in the moment. That's just not going to happen. It's a very separate skill set.
All right. We've talked a little bit about, you know, what we gain by opening ourselves up. What does the audience have to gain, or what do they have to lose when we wall them off?
Well, every art form in the Middle East is about entrainment in a meditative state. The visual art, the tile work, all the infinities, the music, all the tarab singing, it's all about like being in this state, you know, this sort of exalted state, this state of joy. Now, tarab is usually translated as musical ecstasy. And if you look at the root of ecstasy, it basically means being in a state of joy. So hence the whole bring the joy thing. this is what the dancer does. The dancer brings the joy. The dancer makes the party. And I danced at my aunt and uncle's 50th wedding anniversary once, quite a few years ago. And this was the first time that it really became clear to me. It was the week of one of Elena Lentini's week-longs, and it was the 4th of July that they were having their thing, and we had our party on the 3rd of July. So, of course, and her parties went so late. So, like, we're partying until 3 o'clock in the morning. There are people dancing, and the musicians are playing, and it's just incredible. So we kind of roll into the airport. We're going to my aunt and uncle's with my father and his girlfriend. We checked in too late, and they wouldn't let us on the plane because they oversold the plane. So it was this hideous nightmare. Couldn't rent a car, 4th of July. Had to take a taxi from the airport to my aunt and uncle's house. And we get there, and we're like gaga with fatigue. And my aunt meets us at the door. Is me and my friend Stuart, and she says, "You're still gonna dance, right?" And I was like, "Absolutely, yes, right now. I'm gonna go put on my costume right now." So I go and I put on my costume and lots of concealer, you know, over my black circles under my eyes, and I come out, and they're having their thing in the Elks Club, and it's like this gray place, and these gray people are eating gray food, and nobody is talking, and nobody is having any fun, and it's just like and there's not even a proper stereo. There's like a little tiny boombox and a microphone that is attached to like a little PA. So my cousin has to hold the microphone up to the teeny tiny boombox to make any sound. And it's like, all right. And I start dancing, and all of a sudden everybody is happy. People are clapping, everybody's smiling. I make my cousins get up and dance. I make my aunt and uncle get up and dance. I make them dance together. Everybody is laughing. Like, finally at the end, I had put on some Debki music, and we have a Debki line because, you know, my family's Lebanese. And all of a sudden it's a great party. And I was like, I get it now. I didn't really get that before, but it really is something special that happens. The dancer makes the party and gives everybody permission to enjoy themselves. So that's the first step, because if you're busy being impressive, you're not busy having a really great time and sharing that with the people. So you don't really quite get as much of the party feeling happening. And if you're open and sharing, I mean, sometimes you have a crappy audience. And a lot of time, frankly, dancers are a crappy audience because they're busy judging you. They're sitting in the front row and squinting at you, trying to decide what color beads those are on your belt, or, you know, what that costume would look like on them, or, you know, what on earth is that move that she's doing? I used to get thrown out of my zone a lot by the audience. You know, I would do something and the people would just be like squinting at me, like, and I could tell, you know, they're thinking, what the hell is she doing? And I realized later that that's not necessarily what they're thinking. They're thinking, if I leave here in half an hour, I can be home before the babysitter has a fit. You know, they're thinking about themselves. They're not necessarily even thinking about me. But it was very disorienting. And I've like learned my way through that. But the more you can genuinely put out your joy, the more you have the opportunity to suck them in. And that's another thing. I'm sure that, like, everyone who's done restaurant gigs and bellygrams and things like that, there's always somebody who's like giving you the evil eye. Like, stay away from me, you hoe, just in your, don't come near me. And then by the end, they're happy. You know, they're also in a good mood and they're happy too. So we have that ability to bring that joy. Furthermore, once we are engaged in this idea of dance
of our dance as a connection to the divine. And we bring that into the picture and we make of our performance a benediction and a healing for our guests. We don't have to say anything about that. That's just part of what we do. We can do like transmutation of poisons and pull in their cares and, you know, exude like nectar and blessing for them. And just, we give the gift of love to our guests. They went to a lot of trouble to come and see us. You know, they had to like find a babysitter and get there and make things work. And, you know, they come and they're still like fretting and involved in the outside world. So if we go in there and we're also still fretting and involved in the outside world, then nobody is really going to have any kind of transcendent experience. But we can go in because we've trained ourselves to let go of that outside world. And we've trained ourselves to be open and to open ourselves to the people and to bring that joy and spread that joy all out, all over them like honey. And then when we are free to do that, they are free to do that as well.
All right. So I know that a lot of us who have seen a fair amount of belly dance have seen the difference, right? We see when a dancer is completely open and in love with the music and in love with us and everything is just so sparkling. And we've all seen somebody who's going up and presents this really flawless but lifeless presentation. And I think so many of us understand how much better the open one is, but we still don't give ourselves permission to open up until we feel like everything else is perfect. You know, why do you feel like that is, and what can we do about it?
It's a really good question, and I'm not sure of the answer, but I have a couple of ideas. I think one is because we have never been given permission to open ourselves up. We've been only given permission to squint at ourselves in the mirror and sort of work harder. And we may have this idea that if we work hard enough, all of a sudden we'll be like the dancer, the moving dancer. But I don't think that happens. I think that we have to make a really, and some people just have a lot of personality and it's not hard for them. But for the rest, I'm an introvert. I'm not like everybody's best friend. So for someone like me, and I think for a lot of us, it's a skill that we develop. And I still sometimes will feel like, you know, this like closing down, this like anxious. I don't have any fear before I get on stage. It's only after I get up there that I'm like, oh shit, what did I do? You know, how did I get here? So I actually like build practices into my show sometimes, and I have like particularly my throat and my upper chest, and I will take the time to open those things up. But you're asking me why this happens. So I think part of it happens is fear, because we're just afraid. We have been given a hard time in the past, and we've been taken to task for our lack of perfection. And we're afraid that if we're not perfect, you know, everybody will be bored, everybody will hate us. So we have to like keep trying really hard. I think fear is a lot of it. I think lack of information and permission and skill is a lot of it. And partly, we're all so encouraged to be so perfect. And when you're busy being perfect, you don't have time to be yourself. And it's when you are yourself. I mean, you can be a persona. Everybody is kind of a persona when they're on stage, because we're usually not exactly the same on stage as we are when we're bopping down the street. A few people are, but most of us aren't. But it's really a skill to be yourself as a performer on stage and to be genuine with the people. That's a skill that we develop. And when we're so busy doing other people's dances,
because we're doing somebody else's choreography, or even if we're making our own dances, but we're so busy like following the steps in those dances, it's very hard for us to have enough space to be ourselves and be genuine.
So what are some things that we can do, whether it's in our practice or on stage, to help cultivate those things for ourselves?
For me, breath is very important. I could never get out of my, I could sometimes like get in this zone, but it was very unreliable. And the breath practices allowed me to reliably get into a zone where I had the space and time to be myself and enjoy myself with the people. So that rhythmic breath that I talked about, for me, that was enormously huge. And I don't do that breath all the time, but if I find myself getting thinky, I'm pretty well trained now to drop back into rhythmic breath, and that moves it out. So there's breath practices. I have a practice that I'll build in. I'll actually sometimes build it into a show that I call Transmutation of Poison, where I am intentionally inhaling any negative energy and exhaling nectar. I mean, that's my visualization. That's actually a Buddhist visualization, but it works for me. So I'm inhaling negative energy and exhaling nectar and just like drenching everybody in love. And I think that's a very explicit visualization. And I practice this at home. The other thing is like, we all have so many things that we're trying to practice at the same time. I don't know how anybody actually manages to dance when they're like checking their neck and checking their arms and where's my hands and oh my God, and you know, it's like sucking my gut. You have like 16 things to do. I don't think that that is helpful. So I only practice at most two things at once, but I let those things change around a lot. And one of the things that I practice is being open and up. And I visualize the people all around me 360 degrees, and I practice extending love to them and flirting with them and joking with them, you know, like physically, not necessarily saying jokes. But I practice doing that and sort of being in the moment doing that. And that's also made a big difference for me, because I will kind of do a body scan when I'm in a good place. Like, how does my body show this place? What is happening here? And then I will intentionally place myself. I'll map that, and I'll intentionally place myself in that position. Like, you know, smiling actually does make you happier, and frowning actually does make you concentrate more. I mean, these things have been studied. Reading a nice clean Xerox, people retain less than if they read a crappy one, because they had to like frown and squint and concentrate harder to read the crappy one, and they retain more. And even putting a pencil in your mouth so that your mouth smiles will actually lift your mood. It's pretty ridiculous, but it's true. So I do things to help myself, and I practice those things on purpose. And that makes a difference. So you have to do whatever you do in practice, that's what you're going to do on stage. So if you look at the ground and you look at your feet and you're thinking all the time in your practice, that's what you're going to do when you get out on stage. Or, you know, that's going to be an issue for you. You have to bring that into your practice so that it becomes a conditioned response.
And what can teachers do to help their students open up, or on the flip side, not close up?
I think, first of all, teachers can help their students learn improvisation by breaking things up a lot, so that you're not practicing one thing over and over and over again, like one dance for 2 months. Recitals, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think it really serves anybody to do that. I have a lot of strategies for making fast dances, because I don't really think that belly dancers need to be the Rockettes. I mean, it's very martial to have that sort of lockstep kind of
unison, and I don't find it special or anything, and I don't think it helps anybody. So I change that kind of stuff up a lot. With the way that I was taught in Bobby's classes, no matter how many times I went to class, we did something different. I went four times in a week just to see if he would do the same thing on other days, you know, that I wasn't normally there. And he never did the same thing, ever. Not once in years did he ever do the same thing, because he didn't teach choreography then. So every time we went, there was a combination, and it was, you know, pretty complex, but short. I don't know how long of the music it was, because it was a long time ago, but I doubt that it was more than a minute's worth of music, because you can take a long time to really explore a minute's worth of music. It might have even been less, but I don't remember. So there was always a combination. And then we always did stuff across the floor, but what Bobby said was, don't do it the same way as me. Don't do it the same way as everybody else. Bring your own sauce to it. Bring your own feeling to it. Bring your own interpretation to it. He told us that all the time about everything. He would bring other people up to the front to do whatever it was so that we could see how it looked on other bodies. So we would always have these things across the floor, but we were always being encouraged to make those things our own, as opposed to now, where you're always being encouraged to stylize it down and stylize it down and stylize it down. And the third thing that he did was that we followed him while he improvised. And that was really educational. All those things were extremely educational. And if you look at learning science, those are really top-notch things. All the interleaving, going away from things and coming back, when you're constantly doing new combinations, you're constantly having to be open to how movement goes together, and movement is being combined in different ways and done in different sizes and shapes to different kinds of music. So you're really getting a lot more stuff than if you're just gonna learn one choreography and like that's this semester, that's what you learn is this choreography. You know, you warm up, maybe you do some stuff across the floor, you have some drills. I despise drills. I'm sorry for people who really like them, but this is how I was raised in the dance. And then when I was able to let go, you know, and perform, I could perform. I could perform to live music. I could do all those things, even though I hadn't been explicitly taught how to do them, because that was the way that Bobby taught us. But that's not how people are taught now. Everything is very the infinite possibility of micro movement is constantly being cut back and pared down and made into this little skinny one ideal thing. So as teachers, we can open up these possibilities for our students. We can open things up and we can give them a little more. We can let them close their eyes and just feel how their bodies want to move to the music. You know, we have to be comfortable with those things ourselves before we can effectively teach them. So that's a learning curve for us as teachers. But once we start to enjoy how the dance feels and we start to like have a broader perspective, we can give that to our students.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not even sure how I want to phrase this question, but you know, I teach improvisation as well, and I feel like the group that has the hardest time mm-hmm. with this is very experienced dancers who have only done choreography for their entire career.
Yes.
You know, you would think that it would be the beginners with the least experience who would be the most afraid, but it seems like it's this very, very experienced group that often has the most trouble. Do you have any suggestions for them to get past that?
Slow movement. Slow movement takes, just like kicks out a lot of blocks because it's so different. So the slow movement and the rhythmic breath is really a great way to start letting go of perfection of form, because all of a sudden form kind of disappears. Taking things like one move, you're going to take one move
And you're going to dance the whole song with that one move so that you really have to start varying it and playing with it. And you don't have to think about anything because it's only one move. It's not like, you know, you have to do three or, you know, a million or whatever. You only have one. So maybe you have an infinity and that's your one move. And you're just going to keep varying it. And we have to model this stuff for people that one move can be done in so many different ways, in so many different sizes, and like big here and little here and jagged here and smooth here and hard and slow here and light and frivolously here. There's all these timbres that we can bring in. Anything that breaks the pattern of repeated patterns is going to help. Closing the eyes and not having a mirror also helps because you can't look in the mirror. You have to close your eyes and all of a sudden you have to feel how it feels. Professional dancers, one of my teachers, Dunya McPherson, is a Juilliard trained ballerina. And she said, you know, as a ballerina, I was not in touch with my body. None of us were in touch with our bodies. We were in control of our bodies. We made our bodies do things. All of a sudden, when you change it to like very low stakes activity, like slow movement is a very low stakes activity because it's hard to screw it up, right? It's like you're not really doing anything. All and using breath and those things have the potential to radically change things quickly. There was a lot of ballerinas. Professional dancers and ballerinas in Bobby's classes. And I would listen to them talking about how hard it was just to relax the glutes, you know, because the body line of Oriental dance is like the polar opposite of the body line for ballet. It's all like relaxed and gooey. And the other thing that might help to change things is to start getting them to work more with gravity and pushing into the earth. Which seems to, like when I was taught to dance, that was kind of regarded as a very lazy way of doing things. But it is the Eastern way. So to lift the hip by pushing with the foot against the floor, instead of lifting the hip by a few little muscles on the side of your abdomen, it's a radically different way of doing things. So when you strip things down past, like even below a beginner level, and you bring a different kind of technique, that's another way that can sort of start breaking up those patterns.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, we are reaching the end of our program. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about today?
I think that we have been encouraged to, like, I think of this as like sparkly little belly dance, and everybody kind of thinks of it as this, you know, basically innocuous, cute little thing. You know, it's a pretty girl in a pretty costume and it's fluffy and it's nice and all this stuff. But to me, it's like an iceberg, you know, there's that little sparkly bit on top. And then there's this huge amount of like incredibly magical stuff underneath, you know, like brain health and trauma resolution and connection to the divine. And like, where did all that stuff come from? But it's always been there. Always been there. We just didn't have the opportunity to see it because we are only able to see the surface because that's all we could see in the mirror. It wasn't easy to get that other information. So the conclusion that I've come to is that belly dance is like as great or even possibly better than any of these other mind-body practices out there, you know, Tai Chi, Zen archery, meditation, all of that stuff. Because belly dance is, to me, it's a glorious marriage of the sacred and the profane. So you have all this like great, sparkly, sexy, wonderful music and, you know, deliciousness and bodies and moving and pleasurable movement and stuff like that. And then you have this like fantastic capability to connect to the divine and just like bring sunlight into your life and the lives of everyone around you just by having fun.
it's miraculous. This is a very old dance. We don't know how old it is, but we know it's pretty darn old. And it's resisted all of this patriarchy. It's resisted all of this misogyny. It's resisted naming and shaming and blaming. And still millions of people are doing this dance in countries that are incredibly patriarchal and incredibly misogynist. I mean, really, a lot of modern Islam is like managed to take on an awful lot of misogyny, as has modern Christianity. We have a lot of very like female negative stuff built into our cultures, not just there, but also here. You know, women are sort of expected to do what they're told. And this dance is totally not about doing what you're told. It is about total and complete dancer agency. The dancer is an artist who is free to interpret the music how she chooses in the moment. I mean, yeah, we need to learn technique and all of that stuff, but we learn, what is it, the Lemery quote, the purpose of technique is so that the body is free to express itself, you know, without any kind of issues or stumbles. So it's just this incredible, miraculous, magical thing that, you know, transmits wonder. And that's what we have. That's our dance. We have so much potential in this dance to do incredible things.
And if people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
Well, they can visit my website. My book is coming out. It's at the Book Designers now. So there are some pre-orders. I actually made a little tiny special just for geek people that's good for a week or whenever I rewrite the main page. when the book designer finishes and the book starts to move into production, at that point, pre-orders are finished. And I don't know when that's going to be. It's probably going to be within the next week or 2 weeks or whatever. So
today would be the ideal time to do this.
This is a limited time offer. So it's like the pre-order prices for the ebook, the paperback book, and the hardcover book, signed hardcover book. But then there's a special bonus. I have a recording of a ballady technique workshop that it's like gets into, it's more, almost more of a lecture than a dance class. It talks about the ballady character and some of these same techniques that we're talking about using the ground and using the eyes and letting the music come in, because ballady is usually done as improvisation. So that is a special bonus for anybody who wants to buy through this, like pre-order the book through this call. And then if you go all the way up to the hardcover book, you get the ballady workshop and a performance skills workshop that accompanied this.
Awesome. So how do people get that?
I made a special page just for y'all. And I think share screen or file. That's not what I want to do. I need the chat. I'm going to stick this in the chat. And it's aliathabit.com, which is my website, and then /midnightgeek. And I just stuck that link in the chat bar.
All right. That's aliathabit.com/midnightgeek. Awesome. And that's going to be open for a week or so, or until whenever pre-orders close. But since we don't have the date, right now while you're listening to this is the ideal time.
Yeah, a week-ish. The book is pretty. Morocco read the book for me. She read it as a reviewer, and she called me up and she said, I cried when I finished it because I realized that I was no longer alone. Like, everybody who reads this has been, oh my God. So the book is pretty good. It's probably in paperback. It'll probably be between 200 and 250 pages because I put in about 40 illustrations. So it's the whole, all these, and then there's the fourth part, the bonus part is like a how-to part for teachers and students. So that's all in there too, how to develop a personal practice and how to bring this stuff into your teaching.
Awesome. Well, we're going to go ahead and open this up to questions and answers from our listeners. So if you are listening on the webcast only and not through your phone or mic and speakers, there's a little chat box on the right-hand side that looks like a question bubble with three dots on it. And you can type in your question there. Or if you're on the phone or Skype, you can press ** to unmute yourself. We'd love to hear any questions or your favorite thing that you picked up from this. Hi there. It looks like we've got a caller in Seattle. I'm showing you up as unmuted, but I don't hear you yet.
Oh, what about now?
Yes, there we go.
Awesome. Hi, this is Jamila from Seattle.
Hi, Jamila.
Hi, and I have a comment, a little question, and a big question.
Go for it.
Okay, my comment is just about the Sufi dancing and the tango. Everything you said is so far up my alley, and I really want to encourage people to look out there and Google some Sufi orders, because there's a lot of really active orders, and that kind of experience is available to people. And I feel like you can imagine what it's like to have a really spiritual experience, but if you go and just do it and chant and move for hours, it's just available, and it's so good, and it makes something a lot different for the experience of the dancer. And same with tango, but I feel like it takes a lot longer to start having fun with that.
Yeah, I agree. The learning curve of the movement vocabulary with tango, but yeah, that. And the body line is completely different, but the principles are very much the same, even though it's like a couples dance. It has all these like same principles about, you know, just sort of like going there in the moment.
So my little question is, what would be an appropriate course of action for a teacher if they notice a student in class going into a trauma response kind of mode?
Change what's happening, because they're either going too high or too low. So you want whatever kind of music you have, you can change the music. You can have people open their eyes, because one of the quickest ways to settle is to open your eyes and ground in the present moment. Like, look around at the things in the room, look at things, and you want to like make your space as beautiful and soothing as you can anyway, so that when people's eyes settle on things, they're looking at beautiful things. And to use breath, to use those long exhales to help people like relax and release. So all of those things, opening the eyes, grounding in the room, using the exhales, using breath, those things, and just changing whatever's happening, because whatever's happening is contributing. So change the music, change the volume, change the mood, you know, just kind of segue into something else. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Yeah. And my big question is, what have you found to be an effective way of coming back to your body or back to the earth, if for dancers who might have the experience of becoming really open when they perform energetically, and some people might call it channeling or like a minor possession or something. And sometimes I found that that can leave, at least in my experience, sometimes I feel great after, and sometimes I just feel like garbage after. So what's a good way to come back? Or to choose whether or not that's happening during a performance?
That is a big question, and I'm going to try to give you a couple of little kind of short potential avenues for that. So I used to tend to want to go off, kind of, like to get a little bit lost when I performed, because that was like how I could get into the zone. But the more skilled I became at being able to access the zone, the less I needed to do that.
And the more mm-hmm. I was able to be present, not in a trance kind of way, but in a sort of a, I don't even know how to say it. It's sort of like being very, very large and grounded kind of way, spacious and grounded kind of way. So that I was very present as opposed to being sort of out there. Does that make sense, first of all, as a distinction?
Yeah.
So I've kind of learned to be more present. So that's one part of it. Because when you're getting too far off, you're not with the guests.
Mm-hmm.
And so staying with the guests is part of like just sort of changing the mood a little bit from like kind of trancing out to being there, being away to being present. So that's one thing. So the other thing, that's the kind of not going there in the first place thing. And then the second part for when you come back, if you feel great, that's fine. But if you don't feel great, I would suggest, for one thing, eating something sweet. Because you put out so much energy. I used to crash really hard after shows. I don't do it, almost never do that now, but I would just crash so bad. I'd just be like, even if I felt great in the moment afterwards, I would just be like, I hate myself. So I would suggest just eating something sweet to kind of bring your blood sugar up a little bit and kind of moderate that. Also using those breath techniques of the long exhales and grounding yourself in the present moment by using your eyes and looking at the space around you and connecting yourself very, very firmly in the here and now, in the space that's around you. Have something to drink, have something to eat, and go somewhere. You know, if you can even just go somewhere and lie down and rest. Because the resting thing, which I didn't talk about before, but I'm going to take that opportunity now. The resting at the end thing is really huge. Because all of these practices stir up the muck, and resting is the way that the body is able to sweep that muck out. So if you go and you do something that's really like intense like this, and then you run out and go do something else right away, you know, go shopping in a crowded supermarket, that's going to be pretty weird. So giving yourself the opportunity and the luxury of simply resting and letting yourself deactivate, grounding in the present moment, using the breath, something to eat and drink. All those things are very grounding. And just sit somewhere or lie down somewhere for a while and just chill out. Does that seem
awesome.
Like that
Thank
could
you.
Help?
Yeah, that sounds okay. Very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for asking.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jamila. I'm going to put you on mute, but if you think of something else, you can unmute yourself at any point. Would anybody else like to ask a question or share a thought? You can press ** to unmute yourself. Last call.
Hello? Am I there?
Hi there. Yes.
Yeah, it's Charlotte.
Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, I just want to thank both Alia and Nadira for really pioneering this choreography piece. It's just more and more meaningful for me. And it's more about living in the moment, not only in dance, but in my life. And I just want to really give you big hugs and thank you, because it's really enriching my life so much.
Well, thank you. And you're welcome. I'm really
my
glad.
My pleasure. All right. It looks like we've also got Rose. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thank you very much. I agree so much with what I heard tonight. And I hope that the information about the book and the offer is going to be available, because I wasn't able to take notes or anything on what you said. So
yep.
That'll
be available for at least a week.
Yep. And we'll include that. We'll have a link to that on the episode page by tomorrow.
Okay, that's what I'm asking for. Thank you.
Yep.
Very, very
And
happy
if anything
to
goes wrong, you tell me.
Okay, thank you very much. Really
My
enjoyed
pleasure.
Your talk.
Good, thanks. I'm really glad.
Thanks, Rose. All right, would anybody else like to jump in? Questions, comments, favorite thing you learned? All right, then go ahead.
I have just one more connection I'm making. I've been doing eccentrics. I don't know if you know eccentrics. It's a conditioning work that someone here in Montreal has pioneered. She's on PBS. Miranda, I can't think of her name now. Oh, well, it's called eccentrics. And she's working a lot. She says relaxation is the new strengthening. And she's working a lot with, it's called Aging Backwards, some of her DVDs and stuff. And she talks about, there's stuff on pain relief. People have pain in their body. She talks about going right to where the pain begins, right at that point, and then stopping and pulling back a little bit. Mm-hmm, and in a way, you're tricking your mind to think it's going to be okay to relax a little bit more.
Yes.
Mind sends the signal to the body. And then gradually, if you keep doing that, you will be able to push forward into
yes.
the places where the pain is, and it will start receding.
Yes.
And that really connected with a lot of what Ali was saying about trauma. So
what was the gal's name?
Esmond White. Miranda Esmond White. And she's like 68, 69. She was a ballerina. She injured herself a lot. And she started doing...
put her name in the chat bar so I would remember.
Yeah. And she's been on PBS a lot. Anyway, I'll put her name in. She's done things... I think her latest book is Aging Backwards.
I like that idea. Sick of aging already.
I'll put her name in. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody else? This has been good stuff so far. All right. I think we're going to call it a night. So first off, thank you so much, Alia.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this with you.
My pleasure. All right. And thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We do have a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members. So when we send out the call recording for that, we'll include a link. That is a private group, so you have to ask to join, and we have to approve you before you can get in. That's just how we make sure that it's a safe place just for dancers. So don't worry if you can't post right away. And when we send that out, I'll also include an email link to the call recording so you can listen to this again if you missed anything, a link to Alia's book, and also a link to our feedback survey. So if you have any topics or speakers or improvements that you'd like to suggest, that's the best way to do that. Our next call is still to be scheduled. That's going to happen sometime in March, and I'll let you know shortly. So be sure to watch your inbox for that. And the last thing that I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of Clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would like to join us, you can invite them at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Happy dancing. Good night. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.